Welcome, everyone, to the Brand Builders Podcast. We are back. We are continuing our deep dive into the world of brand building, exploring some old forgotten texts on brand building. But before we get into that, my name is Tim Montgomery. Nope, Tom Montgomery. And I am your illustrious guest host, along with the man, the myth, Preston Rutherford.
Preston Rutherford is
Parston.
The correct pronunciation.
That's right. That's right. I forgot. Parston Rutherford. and we are here today to continue our exploration of, if this is your first time listening to the old Brand Builders Podcast, I'll say it's in its nascency. It's in a formative state. It's like a, you know, 1 month old, still learning about the world here. But the intent is to, you know, we, Preston and I are the co-founders of a company called Chubbies. And we started that business in 2011 and sold it in 2021 after a lot of ups and downs and a lot of missteps. And the business is continuing to crush it today. Went through an IPO, had a lot of really fun stuff happen. Via that, we have a lot of kind of failures, learnings, whatever that we wanted to kind of share. We also think a lot about branding and brand building, and wanted to have some space to talk about it and, hope that listeners find it useful. And one of the ways we're starting is to just explore, books, texts, blogs, articles, ad campaigns, whatever, but respond to some sort of content that we think is interesting or that is thought-provoking for us. And currently, the content we're diving into is a book called Kellogg on Branding in a Hyper-Connected World. And if you haven't read it, check it out. Big thanks to the folks at Kellogg. And Wiley Publishing, of course. Can't forget the publishers.
Good people over there. Really good people
good
over
folks.
There.
Yeah, good folks. And the reason we're diving into Kellogg on branding is that when we were first starting Chubbies in 2011, we were each 25 years old, wet behind the ears, young whelps. In the first version of this, it wasn't yet in a hyper-connected world. It was just Kellogg on branding. We drew a lot of learnings on it, and it kind of inspired a lot of the way we thought about the Chubbies brand, and how we positioned things from day one. And so it was fun for us to revisit. Today we are continuing this exploration of Kellogg on branding. We'll have other episodes that you can check out, on sections 1, 2, and 3. The book is broken down into these sections that are composed of themselves, a few chapters apiece. And this one, we're digging into section 4, which I'm already forgetting the name of the section.
It is lessons from brand builders.
Lessons from brand leaders. Close, Preston. Lessons from brand leaders.
Yeah, I thought I learned to read once, but that's why I'm having so much trouble getting to this book. I actually haven't learned to read.
It's tough. I assume what words say as opposed to reading them there.
This is what I prefer that the book says. Yes.
And so the first three sections were all about kind of themes talking about the way that they think about brand building, how to brand build in a digital age, things like this. And this whole chapter was more specific examples, or this whole section was more specific examples. And so they talk through McDonald's as an example of how to think about purpose and brand purpose. They talk about Ulta Beauty as an example of how to, particularly for a retailer, how to balance building your brand as the retailer versus building the brands of the products that you sell. They talk about John Deere. They talk about Novant Health. They talk about rebranding Mexico. The entire country of Mexico went through a rebrand. and so anyway, that's what we'll talk through. And Preston and I have each called out a couple of interesting topics and a couple of interesting tactical applications that will kind of be the rough scaffolding of the conversation. But hopefully we explore and get rangy and loosen up a little bit. With that, Preston, I'll turn it over to you to kind of kick off your first interesting topic for us to delve into.
Thank you. Tim, or is it Timmis? Ooh. Timmis?
Tim. I go by Tim.
Timmery?
These days.
Okay, good.
T-H-I-M. Well, that's good. Tim.
I like that. I thought it was T-H-Y, but then again, I don't know how to read, so it's probably not correct. Well, thank you for that wonderful introduction. One other thing I would add to the nascency of what we're doing is this. I would say one of the things that we talk about is the importance of getting started, even if you're embarrassed with the output, so that we can start to learn and learn by doing and make mistakes. And while there is, I think that's sort of the key point that I would like to convey is like, we will make this podcast better and better over time. And to the listeners, I think this is episode 11, which is crazy. And hopefully it's gotten a little bit better as we go along. A lot of room for improvement. So thank you, watcher, listener, reader. If you're just read transcripts, who knows? Those, I guess, exist.
Smeller.
Thank you. So if you're a smeller, then shoot, thank you. Because we're trying to be consistent with the things that we think are important, and we're going to try to make this thing better over time. But thought that the process of starting was important so that we could learn how to do this stuff better and get some of this information out there, albeit in an imperfect fashion. The thinking is, it being out there and ideally processed in a way coming from a perspective of folks who've been out there making mistakes, trying to do it, would be net beneficial. So that's maybe one note on the nascency, quality, production value-y sort of stuff here. So we're working on it. We're going to add sort of like a cool intro, might add some tunes, you know, might get better at editing out moments where
start off with some Metallica.
There was some Metallica, Enter Sandman, or
oh yes,
one
Enter Brandman, Enter Brandman,
Enter Brandman. That's really true. That's
Ooh,
really
that's
true.
That's the new name of the podcast, Enter Brandman.
I think Metallica, at least some of them, live in San Francisco. So I should go just door to door and ask,
dude,
"Are you
yeah.
the lead singer of Metallica?
Yeah.
Are you Lars?"
Lars? Lars?
Would you like
no,
to drum
I am
for
not
a podcast
Lars.
With 10 and a half episodes? And 6 subscribers on YouTube?
Listen, we got this idea. You know your song? You remember your song, Enter Sandman? We're brand builders. We thought of it as Enter Brandman. Can we go ahead and get those rights now? I think it'll work.
You want to drum live for the intro? So... So the first thing that I thought was kind of cool was, so examples are great, right? Examples are super cool because it takes something that's mentioned in kind of like a theoretical sense, even though you kind of have to, when writing about a situation, you don't always have perfect information. And there's all of the caveats and flaws associated with taking something that happened in real life and turning it into a, you know, 4-page summary. But it's still really cool to hear from the people who were doing these things, which I think applies to all of these chapters here. And I could be wrong, but for the Ulta one, that was being written from the perspective of the person who was the CEO, who came in to be the CEO, which is just really cool. You don't always get that kind of information. So I think just from a content source or believability perspective, that stuff's cool, rather than something that has been processed by a journalist and made to be optimized for, I don't know, other things that maybe aren't focused on
a teacher.
Learnings for, or a teacher, that is maybe more, hasn't really done it, or might be so tied to the theoretical. Because I think one of the things that pops out of this example, and I'll give a quick summary, is the balancing of the practical, the need to just sales deal with changes in how the business is performing, drive short-term performance with this longer-term project. So the summary here, this is chapter 18. So section 4 goes from 17 to 24. Chapter 18 is about this branding makeover that Ulta Beauty went through, where the one big idea is they started, I think, in 90 or sometime in the 90s. And there was a feeling internally. What was that?
1990.
Then there was a feeling that, hey, we're talking so much about all of the brands that we carry. What about the Ulta brand? And the process started with the CEO coming in about 2013. And just fast forward, the project was, let's build the Ulta brand. And as we kind of harp on about in other conversations, or a note that we try to touch on, is the importance of the financial outcomes of brand building efforts. It's not doing it for the sake of, okay, we want a new logo, so let's get a new logo. The why is to drive profitability. And so fast forward, in 2018, the business enters the Fortune 500, which is fantastic. I think a tripling in earnings per share of the business, and doubling or more of revenue, if I'm not mistaken. So not attributing everything to just this branding exercise, but I guess if the results were the opposite, it would have been a less interesting article. And so then the things I think that we can then talk about or take away from this experience, I think have a level of weight or believability to them that is quite cool. So a couple of the things that I found interesting in the Ulta example, the idea of just the one, it wasn't sort of a complete, let's go back and start from nothing. It was more just like, well, we have something. Let's just rediscover and make sure we understand what it is. Partially from our perspective, but then also from the perspective of our customers. Like, why do they view us as differentiated? Do they know why they purchase from us? And that, I thought, was maybe the most obvious approach, I guess. But sometimes I just wonder, like, what do these things look like? What do these projects look like? How deep do you cut? What is the strategic approach? And I just sort of felt like, okay, yeah, that makes sense that you would do something like that.
I mean, like the segmentation and all that stuff that they did.
Yeah. Just like kicking off the process of like who our buyer is.
Yeah.
Do they know like why we exist, why we're differentiated? Do they understand this notion of being able to get, was the fundamental thesis of the founders still intact today? The reason for starting it, this whole idea of there seems to be a missing piece of being able to get, I guess, is it prestige and mass all in one place, these different brands in one place? They felt, no, there was sort of like your mass retailers. I don't know whether it be like the Walmarts, and there's sort of like the Nordstrom and more elevated retailers, but no one where you could, as one person, access all of these in one place. Did the consumer, did the customer still view that as the reason to believe, or the reason why they shopped? So yeah, I guess that's sort of what I was referring to. So I thought that was kind of useful. The other thing that that I thought was just interesting is just sort of like expanding or reevaluating the places where they're effectively distributing communications. And just taking a fresh look at that. Again, nothing. I think my through line is just like the things that I think you would probably do or think about doing if you were going through this process yourself, they did. And so I think from the perspective of, hey, if you're listening to this and you're feeling maybe some of the similar things that either bring more attention to ourselves, if you're kind of like a multi-brand retailer, or if you run a single brand, and you're sort of thinking maybe not necessarily a reset, but maybe an updating or a clarification, but the process might seem daunting or scary or whatever. It hopefully this example proves it, like, or helps support the idea that no, it's not. It's sort of like the things that you might think would be a part of the process. A couple of the others, like, they still handled day to day. Like, there were still times when they were missing sales. They didn't necessarily, one of the things that in brand speak talk about is sort of like cognizance of discounting and promotions and sales, not necessarily hesitance, but cognizance. And just another takeaway is just they still did that stuff. They still were able to do those things in a conscious fashion, because again, there was the balance of the today and tomorrow, if you will. But again, hearing this come from the CEO and then hearing the financial performance that came out of it, that it wasn't just, I think it would have been one thing if it was just, yeah, growth in revenue due to increases in store count without increases in earnings per share. I think that would have been one thing, but the growth and like the sustainable growth in both top and bottom line, which is a lot of what we talk about, that should be the output of brand strengthening activities happening, I think was just sort of like, huh, that's pretty cool. Yeah. So I like the Ulta example for all of the reasons that I mentioned, but I'd love to get your thoughts, because I know I just provided a very sort of like high level thing. But yeah, I would love how you thought about it.
Yeah, well, I'll call out a couple things that I thought was interesting and then get your take on some of this. So one of the things I thought was really interesting was the CEO was brought in by the board, but had like immediately like a 5-year remit. Like the CEO talks about this being like a 5-year brand journey, which like to me, that was like, that's an incredible amount of time, right? Like, it's nuts to be like coming in and thinking about what am I doing today to accomplish this goal in 5 years. And when you think about that length of time, there are sets of activities that you start to do today. It's not like what's your plan for the year 2018. It's like what can you do today that builds a platform for more and more and more growth into 2018, knowing that you might be risking short-term stuff. Now, like, right, it doesn't look like they came into that, that came to a head, which, you know, I'd be interested in your take on, but like, I thought it was good and prescient that the board and the CEO were both like, yeah, it's 5 years. Like, let's give ourselves time on this.
Yeah. Great point.
What was your, how totally. Do you, like, as a startup founder, you're like, I don't have 5 years. But like you probably do, you know, like you probably do can think about that in that regard. But how did you think about it? Because Ulta like has massive base, has profits, 5 years, they'll still be around. How do you think about balancing that for small companies?
Your point resonates, which is as a startup founder, as an entrepreneur, the knee jerk is, I don't have time for that. That's too long. That's impossible. But then the reality number is 9 times out of 10 is just a filler for often you do have that much time, right? I mean, it'll probably take at least twice that long for your business to reach material scale. There are obviously outliers, but you do have that much time. And I think that's one of my biggest lessons from our experience is I tend to be very tactical today, short-term focused. And I think a lot of what I've learned from you, and I think a lot of what we saw led to our success is just this ability to continue to come back to and optimize for the long term. And obviously balancing the needs of today with the long term. But yeah, I mean I love this. And then I think the point I would want to make to respond to your question is based on my experience, the answer to is 5 years too long or impossible for a startup founder or for a new brand founder? No. I mean, I think that's like the perfect time frame. And yes, to think that it doesn't apply is, I think, a mistake that I personally made because I felt exactly that way. But the lesson is, it's a perfect time frame.
And not only that, it must be. Like, it's almost like if you're thinking about your business in the, and this is maybe obvious, but just like there, if you're like, what can I do to grow, maximize growth today? That's not always the right solution. In fact, growing before you understand your business and what keeps that growth, how will you be retaining that growth? Are people liking the stuff that you're growing with? Like, that just takes time. And whether you're in software or selling shorts or whatever, allowing yourself to chase this like VC Silicon Valley blitz scaling idea, which is like pioneered by this VC, who, like, no offense, but like VCs have to deliver returns on a certain time horizon that is typically 10 years, but they want to get returns as fast as they can because that makes their fund look better. Then they can fundraise on the next fund because they've already delivered returns of X. You know, like, it is really good for VC if their cycles are fast and they quickly get to an answer. Like, is this thing big or is it not?
Right.
And we, well, as the founders...
That's the exact point. The one other thing I might just add to your point to add on to it is they want to get their company to the next raise as quickly as possible. So it's not even like the 10-year fund timeline really turns into like an 18-month thing that they're optimizing for so that they can mark up their portfolio, right, especially if you're a new fund, right? And then go back to your LPs and say, hey, this is how this fund is performing based upon current valuation. Exactly. So they use that
stuff too. The fundraising cycles are so fast. Yeah, they're so fast. Like, there'll be fund 4 and fund 5 is like 6 months later. and this is no offense to VC. I was in VC. But you can see how it causes founders to feel like, oh shit, I gotta go. I gotta blitz scale. I gotta get to 50 million users tomorrow. And like, if I have the option of doing that and spending a bunch of money to do that and not doing that, or not spending that money, I'll choose to spend the money, which can get you into trouble because you don't know what your product is. Your users don't know what your product is. And so you might have the nugget of something that could be incredible if you let it grow organically. That's one. And then the second is, you know, Paul Graham talks about this like idea of expanding your surface area for luck, right? Give luck more and more opportunity to take your business and send it to the moon, that sort of thing. And necessary for that is being in existence. And so there's this element of like the moment you've got a business, it has to survive. And like, that's the most critical. It's one of the most critical things because it expands your surface area for luck. And one of the things that is always interesting to me is just how long these businesses that are massive and profitable and all these things that we all aspire to kind of build towards, how long they've been around. Like Preston, I think you had a post today that like Hermes is always just like a crazy business, like the highest profit margins I've ever seen. But a business that's been around for such a long time.
Yeah.
And, And by focusing on kind of the things that matter, but making sure you're not getting ahead of your skis, always crafting great product, building great brand, having great experiences, but doing so in an economical way, you're just expanding your surface area for luck. You're expanding the ability for people to be like, oh, I really like that. Tell people about it, all that good stuff. So anyway, that's one of the things I took from this is this idea that 5 years and like just longevity is so important. And if you're thinking about what do I do today to build a platform and a base for 5 years from now, it's things that we missed in the early days that is like, well, a bit of that is like learning what your product should be. Because you don't like day one, you don't know, and your customers are going to give you feedback, learning how your product should evolve, right? You launch a product and maybe that product is sick day one and it has a lot of traction, but particularly in like fashion, maybe it goes out of style. You got to have the follow-up. How have you used the success of that product to build the base for 5 years from now, knowing that that product might stop selling or the competitor might launch something better? So anyway, I thought that was really, really useful. The other thing
point, if I may, and please, I'm so sorry to cut you off, but just, we were talking about Hermes, we were talking about 5 years, and we were talking about your point about it taking time to figure these things out. So I'm going to try to bring all these, those three ideas together right now.
Yeah. A little point synthesis? Heck yeah.
For the audience. Yes. Yes. Watch this. So Hermes, the big bags are the Birkin bag and the Kelly bag. They do, I think, over $2 billion a year in sales. Huge. I have no idea. The point I'm trying to make is this. So Hermes, 5 years and understanding your product. The product didn't sell for 5 years. It was a dud for 5 years. And can you imagine launching a product and having it be a dud for 5 years before it starts to show that this could be maybe the next hero? That blew my mind. And so then the first thing I thought of when I heard that was like, well, that's impossible. I couldn't wait 5 years to have a product be out before you see results. But that's, I think part of what we're saying is there's, maybe it's not that black and white. There's, and I don't know what they were doing. I really don't have context, but I just thought that was really interesting that this product that is now the icon, such an iconic, globally known product with such desire for it, you know, didn't do anything for 5 years. And
maybe
it's something interesting about timeline.
And maybe kind of speaks to that being valuable. Because like, it's probably not the case that they introduced this thing and they were like, oh, that thing stinks, and didn't change it at all. Right. Didn't play with it.
Right,
didn't refine
right.
it. Didn't hone it.
Right.
Didn't take feedback on it. How does this embody luxury? How does this, and iterate on it? Right. And so there's something fantastic about failure because you're figuring out options that don't work. And almost, you know, in a weird way, finding that immediate win that everybody knows they want and tries, but then realizes, oh, this isn't perfect. It's worse because you've burned all those people, as opposed to now you're iterating through, you're working, you're refining, you know that you've got to improve this thing. Whereas case one, you don't know you've got to improve anything. Case two, where you failed the whole time, you're fixing, improving, tweaking, playing with it. And then it hits. And the way that it hits is in a refined way where now you've got history, you've got craft behind it. You've got a lot of like, iteration behind it. That's a great story to tell. To kind of recap, one of the things, they're like central unifying thesis of this, this is going to define our brand strategy from 2013 to 2018, and beyond, but is this phrase, all things beauty, all in one place. And when you hear it, you're like, okay, yeah. isn't that what everybody's doing? You know, like that's a way to frame something that seems just very simple and obvious. And but within that is this notion that right next to each other are your mass products and your luxury products. Within that is like location, that it's in a place. And so like, I think that it encapsulates how they think about their business and have thought about their business from day one in a very simple way. That's like, if you're telling it to a customer who lives in, I guess the thing that I put in here was like, your audience is not composed of like master's English students who are going to be really critical of how florid your language is and you know, how creatively compelling it is. It needs to be digested and understood. Like, oh, all things beauty and all in one place. And there was another example from the McDonald's story that was like, their brand theme was hot, tasty food quickly, conveniently, and inexpensively. And it's like, again, like that's not a clever brand campaign sort of thing. Now they'll wrap brand campaigns around that very simple central theme, but a lot of times I would feel the pressure personally to be like, that's not cool enough, that's not interesting enough, or whatever. And when I first read that, I was like, oh yeah, but then I was like, oh, I guess that's really easy to understand. And then as you learn more about the market and you think about, okay, typically it's striated. Typically you can't get all things beauty in one place because you've got mass retailers over here who sell all the mass products and luxury retailers over here who sell all the luxury products. So that's a novel concept and it's simply explained. So I thought that was a great thing. And then easy to wrap kind of everything else around. It's like, okay, how do we show that it's all things beauty all in one place? Like, you know, that kind of speaks to relatively easy creative paradigms and things like that.
Right. What really resonated when you explained that. The part that really resonated is when you likened it to your experience of the tension and the pressure, maybe and not that it's all bad, but being able to look at this like simplicity, simple, straightforward, and sometimes feel that, gosh, there's just this weight of having to be and say the most brilliant, witty, creative thing. Having pressure and a high standards is great, but I think as I look back and what really resonated is maybe I conflated some of these things to where the thing that was required wasn't necessarily finding the most interesting, creative, witty, cool way to say something. You know, maybe it was something else. So anyways, that really resonated
flexible. I think one of the things that we got sidetracked on a little bit was like flexibility and like, what do we have the credibility to go do with this brand statement? And so the other thing that I liked about both Ulta's and McDonald's is like, no, it describes who they are now, not who they might be in 10 years. It's like, this is who we are. And McDonald's, it's not an aspirational thing. But like, this gives us the wiggle room to get into cold, you know, not tasty, luxurious food or whatever. And how do we frame it that way? They're like, no, like bluntly, this is what we do in a box and not what we, not what gives us the leeway to go do 100 other things in the future. And I think that's the other thing that you kind of get caught in. And there's a delicate balance there because this is kind of related to some of the concepts you talk about in, I think, section one, which is like brand positioning and things like that.
Right.
But being descriptive of who you actually are now, because that's the clarity your customer needs, is extremely important, as opposed to defining it such that you have the leeway to go do something else, maybe in 2 years' time.
Yeah, well said. Well said.
I have one more. I have one more note on this.
Perfect.
And who gives an F? Because I thought this was cool. I also thought that Ulta, there's sometimes this paradigm that that it's the brand does stuff over here and the retailer does stuff over here. You know, I felt a little bit of this tension, which is like, We would love to be doing the marketing for our presence in a lot of different locations. And similarly, the retailer would love to be doing the marketing about our presence in certain locations. And I thought that their notion, like, first, the way that Ulta started was, we're only going to talk about our brands, right? Then they started talking about, let's combine messaging. So it wasn't like their move we're only going to talk about Ulta. It was, when we can, let's combine Ulta plus our brand's messaging and let's build brand together, sort of thing. And I thought that was a cool model for how brands and retailers can start to develop even more kind of symbiosis of how do we help each other? How do I understand about your business, what you need? Ulta, you need to build your brand. How can I help you with that? And Ulta, how can you help me build my brand? Because oftentimes brands have something that the retailers lack, and the retailers have something the brands lack. And we felt that, and I felt like there was opportunity for even deeper and further partnership with those folks in like sharing in each other's problems and helping to solve those.
Right.
Because I think one of the realizations we had at Chubbies was how critical distribution is for reaching your TAM, for growth and all that stuff. And the complexities of trying to manage all of that digitally, or frankly, through like a fleet of your own stores. It's really hard to do that. They're kick-ass at doing that. And so partnership and like the degree to which a part of their strategy was continuing to do what they were doing for brands, but then blend the branding together, it felt like there was opportunity to share in that, like for that to be more clear and for there to be more kind of sharing of information and data between these folks to help each other out and help build each other's business. And the degree to which you're able to do that, it's a win-win for both parties.
Yes. The one thing I would add there is when Ulta got a little bit more clarity in who they were and exactly what they wanted to look like and how they wanted to come across, that then allowed there to be more pushback, isn't the correct term, but just a focused conversation with the brand in terms of how they're going to work together. What is a fit and what isn't a fit? And the benefit of that seemed to be that both folks ended up winning more, being more successful because of this symbiosis that you talk about, where it felt better. It was more effective. It was more consistent. All of these sorts of things that when they worked together, but when Ulta did the work to kind of get clear on what they were about, how they should look, how they don't look, those sorts of things, it seemed like it was a win-win for everyone. It wasn't just good for Ulta.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be one of the outputs of
that. You want to know what sells the best in Ulta. Like they should want you to know that. They should be sharing in that. And then as Ulta, you want to know what works the best for the brand. You want to know what the brand can bring to Ulta and how you can bring the brand's audience into the store locations or into the website or whatever. Because above and beyond like which product is hot, you want products that bring net new feet into these stores and these retail locations. And so anyway, I thought it was really interesting and gave me ideas for the future of, hey, let's really push partnership. Let's get deeper. Let's share more data. Let's federate more data among our partners, so that we all can play the same game, which is at the end of the day, sell more through your channel. Everybody.
Yes.
To shift our topic a little bit, a little smidgen, we're going to talk about John Deere. And I think we're kind of trying to get into this like more practical piece of the episode that we're calling our tactical applications. So tactical application number one from Shiboy. Tim Mintgamery is talking about John Deere. So John Deere, they had a chapter on John Deere that was all about this kind of John Deere quote unquote rebrand. And I think the thing that stood out for me the most that if you're not even if you're thinking about a rebrand, just as you're thinking about brand, when John Deere went through this rebrand, which the context of which I'll back up a little bit, context of which John Deere is like a multi-100-year-old business that started off with like steel plows back in the 1800s, and now it's obviously what John Deere is. But they went through a lot of sort of industrial revolutions, as it were. The one that they were focusing on here was this like technological revolution, along with changing climate stuff. And so seasons changing and just more dynamism in the farming environment. Okay, so how's John Deere going to react to that? And so they had to go through a quote-unquote rebrand. What rebrand meant for them was like an entirely new way of doing business. And I think for me, the framing of that as rebrand is right, right? Like when you think about your brand, it's not a marketing function. It touches everything that you do. And this is how John Deere approached it. They basically re-architected their org structure such that they went from being product-oriented units to like customer-oriented units. And everything started to be thinking about the customer and responding to the customer's needs. And that was what their brand meant was, okay,
right.
The way we're shifting this brand is to be the partner to our farmers and understand the most about them and what they need and build the products and services that match that. And so it reorged, then it also affected the products they were building such that they were building more technological solutions around how farmers can participate in the four cycles of farming, of field prep, planting, harvest, and I forget the fourth one. But so they architected their whole entire product line and started to shift it around those experiences. That's huge. That's the whole business. But it was under this kind of moniker of rebrand. And oftentimes when we think about branding and things like that, it enters this field where like marketing is the one thinking about it and they live in a bubble and nobody else thinks about the emotional impact they're having on customers. I think John Deere did it right, which is like everyone's thinking about the emotional impact they're having on customers, from the person who's fulfilling product to the person who's building product to the person who's selling product. So John Deere also completely changed the way they worked with John Deere dealers. Previously, dealers were a single store. Like it was basically, I'm a dealer, I have one store. They went right to these kind of mega dealers because they needed to get more in touch with the customer. They needed to be more reactive to the customer. And, you know, their frank opinion was like, given the complexity of that, there are fewer people who are excellent at that. And so those few people who are excellent should be our dealer owners. And that's the way we're going to shift it. And so these dealer owners became like partners to all the local farmers in the region. And they were the kind of spear tip of sales, marketing, customer understanding. And so John Deere also would then rapidly iterate with these dealer partners at the forefront to get things to customers, learn more about them, see how they're working. Is it solving the problem? And if not, let's go try something else. And I thought that was really, really great. It was very cohesive, very kind of full on. And again, I think the big point for me is when you're thinking about brand in general, it should touch everything. And
right.
You should understand that how your brand manifests from a metrics perspective and a measurement perspective is a result of all of these things. Because a great product experience gets shared. A great sales experience gets shared. A great customer experience gets shared. And it's not just a marketing function. In fact, that's probably one of the more minor elements of how your brand comes to life for folks and what causes changes in overall brand awareness, brand engagement, all of these things. And the final thing I'll say here before I turn it over to you, Preston, is also this was also exemplified in their section on Navant Health, which is a nonprofit kind of aggregator of hospitals. And one of the elements that was critical to their rebrand, just to kind of double click on the point, was this kind of framing of make sure your brand and your experience are synonymous. Like the experience with your business is your brand, and you have to understand that.
Right. Yeah, that's perfectly said. One of the things that, well, first, two things. One, it's the takeaway that you took from it is so right. When I looked at it, I was like, this is boring. There's no cool story about cool ad stuff that they did. So this isn't relevant to me. And I'm realizing that is maybe I'm not alone in the way that I would have potentially digested that. At least I hope I'm not the only idiot in the world that kind of first viewed that content in that way. But yeah, you're totally right in that it's that is a small part of the whole pie, right? Brand isn't just ads. Brand isn't just the marketing department, which is exactly the point that you made. And that then, so I just want to echo that, like that's spot on and hopefully a huge takeaway for everyone. And maybe it's an empty statement to say brand is everything you do, but maybe the more actionable or strategically or tactically implementational takeaway is something like how is, and maybe it's like the internal change management piece that I wanted to have as my maybe second point that was crucial in the Ulta conversation, is just like a real constraint, a real reality that the CEO had to deal with, right? I mean, it's any change, but maybe even more so here with John Deere, where it's touching every part of the organization, complete revamp of just what they do, how they operate. It's tied to sort of this high order purpose of, I don't remember what the line is, but something about food or feeding the world or something along those lines. But truly, yeah, turning this organization, these organizations that have been around for decades, John Deere much longer, like that's a real thing. That's a real constraint. And that's, I think, another point echoing to the things that we were talking about, just time, years. The reality is people are involved, and there's institutional inertia. There's ways of doing things that in and of itself just take time. And that requires a lot of context, a lot of communication. And in order to pull something like this off, especially at the scale at which they're able to do it, A shows, well, shoot, certainly possible in a startup context, in a challenger brand sort of scenario. I mean, it can be done, but it still takes time. There are those realities that, you know, there are people involved. So that was also one of the things that I took away, and just how they managed this stuff, the tension, the realities.
If I think about like practically, right, I think I'm really getting huge right now, and you know this, Preston, offline, but just on T-shaped people who do lots of stuff, right? You're not a engineer. You're also a marketer. You're also a product manager. You're also like capable of doing a lot of things. I think one of the things that if I'm thinking about this, how to implement, I'm having my engineers listen to marketing podcasts like the Brand Cultures, you know, like, hey, take it, give it a listen. No, I'm having them learn about this stuff, learn about our customers. I'm having them engage in all of this. And these often sound like platitudes, but they're actionable. Like, you can do this. Similarly, like, what, ignore titles, right? What you want to do, because titles are, it's always shocking to me, sidebar, just how titles are so, they feel so deterministic and they're so not useful. You want to have the deep, like John Deere said, we want to have the deepest understanding of our customer. We want to have the most creative way to kind of solve their problems, right? And there are a lot of facets to that, but you want to bring the people in your organization who can do that the best in front of your customer to talk to them all the time, and to think about every facet of the business. And also, you want to train your organization to be able to do that, to be able to think like marketers and not think that like we all live in silos and I'm going to throw something over to the marketing team and the marketing team will kick it back over to me for this thing. And so broadly, my take on this is, train everybody in cross-functional exercises, one. Two, get your people who are the most talented at architecting great customer experiences at every customer experience in your entire customer journey. Because it's the experience that matters, right? It's when a customer comes into contact with your brand, are they leaving with a thoughtfully architected and crafted experience that hits them, that's creative, that causes them to share, talk about the business, remember the business, that sort of stuff. And so every time, it's your packaging, it's the packaging within your packaging, your poly bags, it's your return card, it's your product, it's your buttons, it's your zipper, it's your in John Deere, it's the steering wheel, it's the, you know, it's everything you've got, everything that a customer comes into contact with should be thoughtfully architected for that experience to be excellent, emotionally resonant, and shareable, ideally. And so it speaks to infusing that DNA throughout the organization.
Yeah, well said. Well said. Hell of a podcast here today.
We potted the casts. We cast a few pots, and hopefully it was useful.
Two pots.
Hopefully it was useful. And if you have any thoughts, your reactions, your experiences, when you've seen this done well, more practical applications of this, please send them our way. We love you all.
We do. Sending love out into the world to you all. Thank you for listening. XOs all over the place. Have a lovely day. Talk to you soon. Signing
exit
off.
Brand man. Exit brand.
Exit. Exit brand man. Lars actually texted me over the course of our recording. And was like, I'm in. So,
dude,
there we go. Yeah.
If you were not joking right now, that is incredible news. Okay. Goodbye. Goodbye, fair listener. Goodbye, internet.
Be well. Goodbye.